The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Dr. Scott Youngkin for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Health Issues. For the next half hour, I'll be reading articles from the Harvard Heart Letter and possibly from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. And the first series of short articles comes from the Harvard Heart Letter of August 2024, and it's from the section called Research We're Watching. The first short segment is, All Types of Alcohol Appear to Raise Blood Pressure. The more alcohol people drink, whether they imbibe beer, wine, or hard liquor, the higher the blood pressure, according to a large Danish study. More than 104,000 adults underwent a physical exam and answered questions about their drinking habits. Nearly three-quarters reported drinking more than one type of alcohol. About 13% said they drank only red wine. About 5% drank only beer. 2% drank only white wine. And 1% drank only spirits. Like vodka and whiskey, or dessert wine. Most had 3 to 14 drinks per week, and fewer than 3% drank 35 or more drinks per week. But the average blood pressure readings among those heavy drinkers were strikingly higher than those of people who had just 1 or 2 drinks per week, 11 and 7 points higher for the first systolic and second diastolic numbers in the reading, respectively. For both men and women, there was a strong graded association between alcohol intake and blood pressure, no matter what type of alcohol they drank. The findings were published online May 13, 2024, by the American Journal of Medicine. The second short article is Counting Steps as Good as Time Tracking for Monitoring Heart Health. Advice about the amount of activity required to stave off heart disease is usually expressed as a time-based goal. Now, new research suggests that counting steps may be just as good for predicting the risk of cardiovascular disease and death from all causes. Published online in the May 20th, 2024 issue of JAMA Internal Medicine, the study included 14,399 women who are free of heart disease and cancer when the study began. Their average age was 72. They measured their activity using hip-worn activity trackers for a week, then completed annual questionnaires about their health habits, medical history, and other personal data. The amount of moderate to vigorous physical activity they did ranged from 20 to 149 minutes per week, while their step counts ranged from 3,691 to 7,001 per day. After a median follow-up of 9 years, researchers found that both time and steps had similar associations with cardiovascular disease and death rates. Current federal guidelines recommend that adults get 150 minutes per week of moderate intensity physical activity, but older people could instead target about 7,000 steps per day. Finally, a short article is entitled, A Brief Bout of Anger May Be Bad for Your Blood Vessels. A short episode of anger may have adverse effects on the cells lining the blood vessels, according to a new study. The findings published May 7, 2024 in the Journal of the American Heart Association may help explain the long-observed link between negative emotions and an increased likelihood of heart problems. 280 apparently healthy adults were randomly assigned to 1 of 4 tasks that lasted just 8 minutes. Recalling a personal memory that made them angry, recalling a time they felt anxious, reading a passage meant to evoke sadness, or repeatedly counting to 100 to evoke a neutral state. Researchers tracked changes in blood vessel dilation using special probes placed on the participants' index fingers. They also measured markers of cell injury or reduced repair capacity in blood vessels before and then 3, 40, 70, 100 minutes after the test. People in the anger group showed signs of impaired blood vessel function compared with the neutral group, an effect that lasted 40 minutes after the task. The anxiety and sadness groups showed no such changes. Now here's an article from the Harvard Heart Letter of August 2024 that's entitled "Chemical Pollutants, a Growing Concern for Your Heart." Contact with toxic chemicals and pollution usually conjures up concerns about cancer or neurologic problems, but hazardous substances in the environment are also implicated in the nation's leading cause of death, cardiovascular disease. The recognition that chemical pollutants can contribute to heart disease is more recent, but it's quite real, says Dr. Philip Landrigan, adjunct professor of environmental health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and an affiliate in the Department of Global Health and Social Medicine at Harvard Medical School. Until recently, the risk from environmental pollution has been overshadowed by other classic heart disease risk factors, he explains. Cardiologists have made extraordinary progress in identifying and addressing those risks. Death from heart disease are far lower now than in the 1950s. But now that fewer people are smoking and more people have their cholesterol levels and blood pressure under better control, the importance of environmental exposure is getting more attention. Chemical pollutants, including toxins, found in air, water, and soil. Of these, air pollution is a leading threat to cardiovascular health, Dr. Landrigan says. Other worrisome contaminants include heavy metals, especially lead, perfluoroalkyl, and polyfluoroalkyl substances, also known as PFAS, PFAS, and pesticides, according to an article in the April 26, 2024 issue of Circulation Research. Where are these substances found, and how might they harm the heart? Lead. Anyone born before the mid-1970s was exposed to lead from breathing exhaust from cars and ran on leaded gas, says Dr. Landrigan. Residue from lead paint persists in homes and other structures built before 1978, and erosion from lead pipes, mainly in homes built before 1986, can contaminate drinking water. Hobbies like oil painting and stained glass making can also expose people to lead. Although your body eliminates some lead through your urine, a portion of it goes into your bones where it can stay for decades. Bone tissue constantly remodels itself, and that stored lead can be released back into the bloodstream. Lead appears to promote heart disease risk by impairing kidney function, which raises the blood pressure. PFAS, remember that's P-F-A-S, known as forever chemicals because they resist chemical and biological degradation, PFAS are commonplace in daily life. They're used to coat food and beverage packaging and other products. PFAS are widely used in aerospace, automotive, and other industries, and the resulting industrial waste means that PFAS often end up in our drinking water and food supply. High blood levels of these chemicals have been linked to increases in harmful LDL cholesterol and plaque buildup inside arteries. Pesticides. Agricultural and chemical industry workers face the highest risk from these chemicals, although people living in rural agricultural areas also can be affected by pesticide spray drift. Home pesticide use to combat weeds and insects is another possible route of exposure, and people may consume pesticide residues in food. So what can you do? Well, you can check your drinking water. By law, municipal drinking water suppliers must provide annual quality reports to their customers, but the water is tested before it leaves the facility. Because lead can leach into water from pipes that supply your home, testing your tap water may be prudent. The EPA provides detailed guidelines. Contact your local health or environmental agency if your water comes from a private well. If your drinking water contains heavy metals, PFAS, or other contaminants, use one of the major water filter brands and be sure to replace the filter according to the instructions. Residue and dust from certain consumer products may expose people to PFAS. These include stain-resistant carpets, upholstery, and other fabrics, water-resistant clothing and shoes, cleaning products, cosmetics, shampoo, dental floss, nail polish and eye makeup, paints, varnish, and sealants. Look for the words PFAS-free, PFAS-free, on labels and avoid products containing ingredients like perfluoro or fluoro in their name. Avoid pesticides. Seek alternatives, non-chemical methods to manage pests at home. Consider buying organic food, especially for the foods you eat most often. Next, I'm going to read an interesting article from the Harvard Women's Health Watch. This is the July 2024 issue, and it's entitled AI's Promise for Women's Health. Artificial intelligence is fueling early detection and preventive strategies that could improve your well-being. Reading a mammogram is a test in discerning overlapping shadows. Since cancer shows up on mammography images as white areas, just like glandular breast tissue, a radiologist's challenge becomes teasing out what's normal from what's not. But radiologists have a secret weapon, artificial intelligence. For years, mammograms have incorporated a technology called computer-aided detection that can flag spots with abnormal cells the human eye sometimes misses. The newest form of AI continue to refine these abilities in ways that may be benefiting countless women. Every once in a while, the computer will circle something we were on the fence about or didn't notice, and it will change our approach, says Dr. Pierre Sasson, chair of the Department of Radiology at Harvard-affiliated Mount Auburn Hospital. AI also reinforces questionable findings we see that make us more confident when we call a patient back for additional testing. That happens every day. But while AI mammography software is heralded as one of the technology's most compelling applications in women's health, it's hardly the only one. And while AI's uses and the fury surrounding them have exploded in recent years, earlier forms have quietly been part of American healthcare for decades. We're no longer at the dawn of artificial intelligence. I'd say we're at mid-morning, says Dr. Sasson. It's already present, already being utilized, and already helping. One of AI's earliest usage in the 1970s and 80s was in computer-aided detection systems designed to pinpoint problems in fetuses on ultrasound images. Today, AI continues to sharpen the accuracy of women's imaging testing by helping detect and track not only breast cancer, but also endometriosis, fibroids, and cervical precancers, among other conditions. Indeed, of the more than 700 FDA-approved AI and machine learning-enabled devices in healthcare, the vast majority are used in radiology, says Dr. Bernardo Bizzo, Senior Director of Harvard-affiliated Mass General Brigham AI, a diversified business that bridges academic research and AI product development. Healthcare uses of AI are still fragmented, but finally it's being integrated into our everyday practice. Particularly in radiology, Dr. Sasson says, I view it as affecting almost every part of a patient's care. AI use in mammography has led to headline-worthy results. An August 2023 study published in The Lancet Oncology indicates that AI-supported mammogram readings revealed 20% more cancers than a routine double reading by two different radiologists. The technology also accomplished this without increasing the rate of false positives found. Unfortunately, I don't have the last section of this article, so I'm going to go on to page 2 of the Harvard Women's Health Watch for July 2024. And this is a series of questions for Dr. Tony Golan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Women's Health Watch. And the first question is, it's happening again. Every summer I get bitten by mosquitoes far more than my family and friends. Why does this happen? You're not imagining things. Some people are inherently more attractive than others to mosquitoes. Scientists are still figuring out why, but it's believed that each person's unique scent, dictated by an array of molecules throughout the body, determines whether mosquitoes like them more than others. This scent isn't something you can modify, like underarm odor, so don't be alarmed. Other factors like blood type and breathing patterns also seem to play a role. Type O blood appears to attract the pests. So does breathing heavily, such as after a workout, which exudes more carbon dioxide around you, which attracts mosquitoes. A few simple strategies may discourage mosquitoes. When you know you'll be spending time outdoors, use fragrance-free personal care products and wear long, light-colored sleeves and pants. Applying an insect repellent on exposed skin can also help. And keeping a fan running, especially around your feet and ankles, where mosquitoes love to gather, can also discourage biting. Finally, the third question is, I've been gassy and bloated in recent months, and my sister suggested I may have leaky gut syndrome. What's that? For starters, anyone who's been dealing with chronic intestinal symptoms should see a doctor. There are many reasons for gas and bloating to persist, and a medical evaluation will help to get to the bottom of things. While leaky gut syndrome isn't a clinical diagnosis, it may be one possible contributor to your symptoms. A leaky gut happens when the barrier between the gut and the bloodstream breaks down due to inflammation in the small intestine. Bacteria and toxins seep through the gut lining and can trigger a variety of intestinal problems like bloating, diarrhea, constipation, or gastroparesis. To determine what's causing your stress, your doctor will likely ask what foods, supplements, and medications you consume. She may also perform blood tests or endoscopic exams of the digestive tract to detect any infections or structural reasons for your symptoms. Sometimes a simple change of diet, like cutting out certain foods or adding others, does the trick. But getting properly assessed is the next step. Now here's another article from the Harvard Women's Health Watch of July 2024. And it's entitled, Feeding Your Fitness. Women's bodies require a different approach to post-exercise replenishment and repair. Diligently training for a marathon, Barbara alternated hard runs lasting an hour or two with easier jogs meant to give her muscles a break. But the 40-something woman couldn't figure out why those short bursts proved just as taxing as the longer treks, leaving her sore and wiped out. The pieces came together when Barbara met with Mary Ann Kelly, a registered dietitian at Harvard-affiliated Brigham and Women's Hospital. To promote fat loss, Barbara confessed, she usually didn't eat after her workouts, but the zero refueling strategy meant she was sacrificing the strength and endurance she needed to train effectively. Those long runs took so much out of her that the shorter runs became incredibly hard, because she was functioning at such an energy and protein deficit, Kelly recounts. Barbara's example highlights a dramatic distinction between the sexes. After exercise, our bodies require an entirely different approach to replace what's been lost and promote muscle recovery and growth. Optimally, women should refuel within 30 to 45 minutes after workout, while men have up to 3 hours to accomplish the same task. Continually ignoring this need can lead to symptoms of low energy availability like fatigue and soreness. As Barbara learned, it's really hard for the body to optimize recovery if we're chronically underfueled. For both women and men, exercise is the best kind of stress, increasing our heart rate and making muscles work harder. But it does require us to nourish ourselves properly to overcome that stress. That's where the similarities end, however. Why is a woman's refueling window so much shorter? Hormonal variations between the sexes underlie this difference, says Dr. Beth Freites, Director of Lifestyle Medicine and Wellness in the Department of Surgery at Harvard-affiliated Massachusetts General Hospital. Progesterone is a primary driver, exacerbating women's post-exercise muscle breakdown. This outcome is magnified for women who are peri- or postmenopausal. If they allow their muscles to remain in a breakdown state without replenishing with protein, and if they consume protein only at the beginning and end of the day, they're more likely to feel sluggish, sore, and unable to exercise at their peak. Women need to refuel with protein more quickly to oppose this breakdown, Dr. Freites says. During the luteal phase of the menstrual cycle, the week or so before a period arrives, women may also crave more carbohydrates and want to eat more. If you feel a little hungrier, it's not in your head. Your body actually needs that, Kelly says. Being mindful of your cycle, listening to your hunger cues, and eating that little extra could support your training. Aim to consume 70 grams of protein throughout the day so that you begin any workout well-fueled. That means your muscles have been topped off and hydrated, and they're ready to tap in for exercise, Kelly says. After exercise, you'll want to ingest about 20 grams of protein within 45 minutes and pair it with carbohydrates if you don't plan to eat again within the next hour or two. Protein-rich food sources include a cup of Greek yogurt, 3 ounces of chicken, turkey, salmon, or steak, a scoop of whey protein powder, or a ready-to-drink protein shake. Even a big glass of chocolate milk can provide an adequate mix of the proteins, carbohydrates, and electrolytes muscles should ideally receive after exercise, Kelly says. If, like Barbara, you're aiming for workout-driven fat loss, you can still meet your goal and refuel properly afterward. Just be strategic so you don't sacrifice muscle strength in the process, Kelly says. How? Aim for a calorie deficit at other points in the day, not after your workout time. Kelly suggests monitoring portions and limiting alcoholic drinks. If someone is doing a light workout like a walk or 20 or 30 minutes on an elliptical machine, the principles of intentional refueling probably don't need to be applied. But if your workout is intense and your ultimate goal is weight loss, pay attention to your overall fueling patterns. Now, we're still in the Harvard Women's Health Watch of July 2024, and here's a short article entitled, "Even Our Sex Lives Aren't Immune from COVID." As if the pandemic hasn't caused enough misery, a recent study suggests that COVID and long COVID can affect women's sex lives, impairing desire, arousal, orgasm, and other factors. The study, which was published in the February 2024 issue of the Journal of Sexual Medicine, is believed to be the first analysis highlighting long COVID's effects on women's sexual health. Researchers surveyed more than 2,300 women online, half of whom said they hadn't had COVID, and the remainder reporting they had tested positive for the infection at one time. One quarter of those who had COVID reported also having extended symptoms, indicative of long COVID. Only women who said they'd had sex in the previous month were included in the results. Participants who'd had COVID reported lower levels of desire, arousal, lubrication, and sexual satisfaction than women who hadn't. Orgasm and pain scores between the two groups didn't differ significantly. But within the COVID group, women who'd experienced long-lasting COVID symptoms had markedly worse scores in arousal, lubrication, orgasm, and pain. It's no surprise, says Dr. Tara Iyer, director of the Menopause and Midlife Clinic at the Brigham and Women's Hospital. Having COVID symptoms puts a lot of stress on the body. Many of the symptoms associated with long COVID, like aches, brain fog, and fatigue, can affect libido as well. The findings also suggest that COVID can interfere with cognitive aspects of sexual function, the mental aspects that tie into having a positive sexual experience, Dr. Iyer says. If you've had sexual difficulties following COVID infection, it's crucial to push past any awkwardness and tell your gynecologist. She may suggest treatments or workarounds for symptoms. It's very helpful if you can see a specialist to address female sexual dysfunction, Dr. Iyer says. Even if we can't say we know the exact causes of what you're experiencing, there still may be treatment available. Well, it looks like we've run out of time for today's episode of Health Issues. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you enjoyed it. I'm Dr. Scott Youngkin, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Health Issues is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Thank you.